This February, Jackson Lucas celebrates Black History Month on the Beyond the Resume podcast by revisiting some of our best interviews. These African-American leaders, pioneers, and industry titans have inspiring stories that hold tremendous value to this day. On behalf of all of us at Beyond the Resume, we hope you enjoyed these throwbacks. Thank you for listening.
All right, folks, welcome to this episode. I am your host, Chris Papa, and today we have a very special guest, Mr. Bua Benitier. Bua is the managing principal at Dante's Partners in Washington, D.C. How you doing, Bua?
I'm phenomenal. How are you?
I am great. How is D.C.? Is it COVID? Is it quarantine? Is it snowy? What's going on?
The weather's actually pretty good today. But we're about to go into another wave of lockdown, primarily because of the holidays. So starting on the 23rd, through January, the mayor's, encouraging folks to stay at home and lockdown.
Well,
so
see, if you moved to the San Francisco Bay Area where I am, you just would never have left lockdown. So you don't know what you're missing. We had like a week. We're open a week. It's like living in Portland, Oregon. You get like a week of sunshine,
Yeah, but it's other than that though, it's been pretty good. It's not the worst thing to, I always tell folks like, we're never going to get this time back again, right? Where we get to slow down. It's like the idea of not sitting in traffic is just very welcoming, concept for me. It's like my commute to my office is literally like 6 minutes flat, right? The air smells better, right? It's great. And I'm stocked up on a whole bunch of athleisure wear. I've got all the suits that I haven't worn this year. I think I can count how many times I wore a pair of suits this year. So it's honestly been great. We sort of embraced this year for what it is and try to make the most of it. So.
The real question is, will the suits fit after this year?
No question about it, because as far as I'm concerned, no question about it, because that's, like I said, I'll never get this time back. So, my friends and I have this goal of cycling 3,000 miles a year, and I believe we all exceeded that, right? And
wow.
I spend a lot more time working out now because my commute time is shorter, so I can actually work out pretty much almost every day now versus before, where it was, a couple of days a week. So yeah, no, it's been, like I said, it's been, it's unfortunate, that we've had, tremendous amount of loss and illnesses this year. There's no question about that. And we feel for those and we pray for those who have lost their family members, especially those who have lost their jobs as well. But I generally tend to look at things. I'm generally a very, very optimistic person. And I just sort of looked at this year and just said, oh, wow, it's almost like, a vacation every day. So let's figure out a way to make the most of it.
I was saying that as cheesy as it sounds, me and my buddies, my core four, we do like gratitude lists every day where, it sounds cheesy, but like it makes me think about like all the positive things going on in my life. And then I read about their positive things in their life. It definitely I feel the human brain, the human mind, like the more whatever I concentrate on, it gets magnified, right? So if I'm concentrating on good stuff, like my life becomes generally like I think about good things, right? Think about bad things, like I think about bad things. So I love that you guys do that. That's awesome. Well, let's talk about your business. That's why we're here, right? What is Dante's Partners? Can you tell the world that's listening what you guys do?
We are an amalgamation of different types of real estate verticals. But I think the thing that we're known for the most is we are a real estate development firm that specializes in developing and preserving affordable housing. So that's I think the thing that we're most known for right now. That's the thing that keeps me busy every day.
And so you guys are buying and or developing affordable housing. Is it mainly in the DC area? Is that generally where you are?
Yeah, so we started off in the DC area and we've grown the company to where we're active in Virginia. We're very, very active in New York, and we have an asset in Maryland, and we're hoping to do more in the state of Maryland as well. So I would say right now, those are the states where we've been very fortunate and welcome to do business in.
How many units do you guys own?
So we break it up into three buckets. So as of today, we have developed over, I want to say approximately about maybe 3,000 units. Mm-hmm. And we have another 3,400 units in the pipeline that we're looking to activate over the course of the next 12 to 24 months.
That's awesome. Congratulations. And you guys, that's a big unit count. So when you go into, I was always curious about that. I've interviewed people from like the Michaels of the world and the Penrose and stuff. Do you guys ever go head to head on the same type of projects when you're trying to compete for bidding on a project?
So for instance, we typically play in the public-private partnership realm. So that's the space that we have had tremendous amount of success in. So we're not heavily capitalized in a way where we don't have the luxury or the liberty to acquire sites. So in the history of the firm, I think we've only acquired or bought one piece of asset that we eventually developed. Two. So in the 14 or 15 years we've been in existence, we've only bought two assets for the purposes of redeveloping. Almost everything we've done has been some form of either public or private disposition. So in those instances, yes, we do find ourselves competing with the big boys, and we've won some and we've also lost a couple.
Why would they choose one organization over another for like these different projects? Do you guys come in differently? Do you like have different costs on the bid? Or like what are really the qualifications on these different projects that they're looking at?
So the way I always put it is it's a beauty contest.
Well, you're a beautiful guy. So you should win all of them.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. Hopefully, municipalities feel the same way.
This is an audio podcast, so everyone has to believe me.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. At the end of the day, right, I think a lot of it just really comes down to the priorities that the municipalities call for in their disposition. Right. And some folks are very creative in how they go about addressing the needs of that particular municipality. And or they're just frankly just also just very amenable. Right. We tend to come across as a firm who, we say we follow directions very well. We sort of have a keen idea of what the municipalities are looking for or the impacted community members are looking for. And we just basically cater our redevelopment plan to those needs, and we do it in a way whereby it's cost effective and beautiful, and yeah, we proceed that way.
And you mentioned public-private partnership. Can you explain what that means in this particular case?
Sure. So public-private partnerships are basically, you're partnering with public entities, and those public entities could be the local government, it could be the state government, it could be, a transportation agency. As you know, a lot of transportation agencies tend to have a lot of land, some of which have been deemed surplus. So basically you're using public land, or in our case, we're using public land for public good is how we sort of encourage municipalities to look at it. Is basically saying, look, especially in high cost, cities like New York and DC, where, it's just exorbitantly expensive to live in. So if the city has a public land and they can use that land to create, you know, affordable slash workforce housing to create a diverse community, why not use the land for those purposes? So our job is to encourage them to do that, demonstrate to them that we have the capabilities to and the financial wherewithal to execute on whatever it is that they want to see done.
So you'll go, like, you'll see how do you find this land? And like, you're driving around DC, you see a plot of land and you're like, that one looks like a good place to build an affordable housing community. Like, how do you find this land, and how do you know which ones are owned by, you know, the public sector?
Is there a you're giving me way too much credit. I don't find the land. You have some municipalities like DC, New York, you know, they sort of have a very good idea of, their inventory of properties. And they sort of, so I'll give you an example, right? Like, I always tell folks about the story about, there's a fire station site, that was old, dilapidated and needed to be refurbished. But at the same time, it was a one-story fire station in a neighborhood that could easily accommodate, you know, 10 to 11 stories, right? So you're talking about, and the fire station sits directly across the street from the Ritz-Carlton.
Nice. Right,
so, yeah. So the district wants this fire station refurbished, create a safe haven for firefighters. As you know, they're risking their life every day to ensure that the citizens of the District of Columbia are safe. So the district put out the RFP, responsive proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And, we were the only ones, myself and my partners were the only ones who demonstrated a plan to the government as well as the community that we could not only replace the fire station on the site, but also introduce affordable housing right above the fire station. And voila, we went. And the building stands today, and so does the fire station as well. So that's an example of how public-private partnerships come about, where everybody gets something, right? We have a new fire station, and we have housing for professionals making below $60,000 a year, living directly across the street from the Ritz-Carlton.
That's awesome. So you had to get creative. Like, and how do you know, I guess you've been doing it a while now, but you can kind of tell, like, hey, you know, this is a property that we can put affordable housing, we can mix it in, right? Like, how do you know what properties can, does it have to be zoned for that as well? Do you have to go to the zoning board and get that all worked out too? Or how do you know where to put affordable housing, like in these type of public-private partnerships when it is like a firehouse initially?
Sure. I mean, obviously having the zoning entitlement in place certainly helps. We've been involved in transactions where we have to go secure the entitlements. However, my company's ethos has always been developing affordable housing in high cost areas. That's been my personal goal. And the reason why it's my personal goal is because it's a personal story for me, right? So I created this company to solve a solution for individuals like myself who, look, I lived in San Francisco, I lived in New York, I've lived in DC, I've lived in high-cost neighborhoods and high-cost cities. And in San Francisco in particular, I told a story how it took me 6 months to find a place to live. So I was living in a hotel for 6 good months because I could not find an apartment that I could afford, despite the fact that I was making good money. And it was a travesty, right? Like, here I am making good money. I just moved from New York to San Francisco. And every time I went to look at an apartment building, I got outbid for rent. So for some people, that's, that sounds unreal, right? But in San Francisco, it's actually a common thing. Right. I mean, in DC, if you're buying a house, you get a bid for the house. Yes, that makes sense. But in San Francisco, I actually got a bid for rent. And we're talking about what? 20 years ago. So I can only imagine what that's like now. So, and I was making good money. right? So for me, I just couldn't compute. But again, at the same time, I wanted to live in neighborhoods within close proximity to the
Embarcadero.
Embarcadero, thank you. Right, I wanted to live in close proximity to University of San Francisco, right? So I essentially got priced out of those neighborhoods because of my income bracket. So I had to commute into the office, almost an hour and a half, almost every single day. Again, despite the fact that I thought I was making good money.
Yeah.
So when I finally decided to start my company, I said, look, I've got to figure out a way to create, this housing for people like myself who don't have to commute an hour or two every single day just to be within close proximity to their job. So we've basically made it our mission, and we've done that over and over again. Like, I don't subscribe to the notion of building affordable housing in a neighbor that is already seeing depressed rents, that is already sort of, already quote unquote affordable. It's like, that does nothing for anybody. Like, why shouldn't I be able to patronize the restaurants? Why shouldn't I be able to patronize the neighborhood coffee shop? Why shouldn't I be able to patronize the grocery store and all of those things that, high income earners have willingly at their disposal? So it's been a very personal thing for me. And the fact that we're doing that and continue to do that is just sort of, again, like I said, it's not a job. It's a passion, it's a mission of mine to be able to do that for individuals and for families and for seniors as well. So.
Do you get pushback from like the Ritz-Carlton?
Do I get pushback from the Ritz-Carlton? I think what you're speaking of is what folks talk about NIMBYism, right? So as you can imagine, there was a lot of conversation around not my backyard because, look, there was a stigma associated with the word affordable housing, right? And I get it. I understand what people mean when they say affordable housing. I think it connotes all kinds of fear that people have of quote unquote poor people. Look, and it's my job to demystify all of that, right? And I get it. I understand. I'm not ignorant to that. And at the end of the day, people live in the neighborhood. They've spent a lot of money to buy their houses where they are and so on and so forth. And no one wants their property value, to be depressed. So it's my job to assure you that is not going to be the case. So this is how we go about doing it. Number one, I tell everybody, look, a Lamborghini is affordable to LeBron James, but guess what? It's not affordable to you and me.
Yeah.
Right. So the word affordable, it's very, very relative. So that's number one. Number two is in high cost cities like New York and DC, the average median income is, I think in DC right now, it's probably $110,000. Mm-hmm. Right. So in order for you to be able to qualify for this housing that we are building, you've got to make at least $60,000. So we're talking about rents that are hovering around $1,300 to $1,500. Tell me anywhere else in the world where $1,300 isn't considered luxury apartment, right?
Yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say? So the thing I do is I say, look, these are the rents that we're charging. And in order for you to be able to afford this rent, you have to be able to make X. And people look at that and go, oh, so that means you have to have a job. And I go, yes, you need to have a job. You're not, you can't afford these apartments if you're destitute, right? This just doesn't work. And at the end of the day, I've got a mortgage that I've got to pay. So I can't afford to lease it to people who are incapable of making those rental payments. So, So those are the steps that we take to educate people. Oh, and by the way, when we talk about property value, look, the thing I always say is, affordable income earners or whatever, like if I'm doing everything I can to ensure that you pay no more than 30% of your income towards rent, guess what happens to all of your neighborhood retailers? I've created space, I've created disposable income for my renters to actually patronize your retailers.
Gotcha.
Right. So these are the things that we sort of share with folks as a way of saying, I get I get the stereotype, I understand it, but that's not been my experience. Like I said, we've developed housing. We've been very fortunate to have developed a lot of housing, and you know, I've done market rate and I've done affordable, and I tell people I do market rate housing, and my tenant or my buyer is pissed off about the fact that, you know, they've got a quarter inch gap in their hardwood floors. Mm-hmm. And my affordable tenant are baking me cakes and giving me hugs. which would you rather have?
Yes.
So I will take your cake and your hugs anytime, any day, because they're very, very appreciative.
Yeah. That's great. Like, how much of it? Okay, let's go back into your story a little bit. So, I can tell by your accent that you're probably from the southeast of the United States. Now, where'd you grow up? Did you grow up in the United States?
Moved to the United States when I was 17 years old. So, a great deal of my adolescence was spent in Lagos, Nigeria.
Gotcha. Okay. Did you move here for school or anything like that? Anything in particular?
I did. My parents thought it was a great idea for me to be educated abroad. So I moved to the United States to be educated. And that's the story that I keep telling my parents, that I'm still in school, and that's
you're still in school. And then where did you end? I see you went to NYU. Is that where you ended up?
Yes, I ended up at NYU, phenomenal school, and got my master's at Johns Hopkins.
Another great school. It says here you got your degree in education. Did you want to be a teacher?
No, it's funny. That's the biggest misnomer about the School of Education at NYU. I enrolled in that particular school because coming to America, I had no clue in terms of what the world had to offer, right? Like, I've always believed that, and I still believe that, the streets of America are paved with gold. It's been my notion from the moment I moved to the United States. So in order not to box myself into one thing, the School of Education was that one school that allowed me, that gave me a lot of flexibility and latitude to take classes in all of the other schools that make up NYU. So NYU is an amalgamation of different schools. So you've got the music school, you've got the business school, which is Stern. You've got the, you know, technology school, you've got the art school. So I just basically created my own curriculum. Obviously, I still had my liberal arts basics that I had to do, but the balance of my learnings there were just basically just going from different school to different school and just taking everything all in before I committed to doing one thing. So that's how I ended up with a bachelor's in education.
And then you came out of there. Where did this interest in real estate come from? Did you grow up in a real estate family? Did you know anything about real estate? Tell me about that journey. Yeah.
You know, to go a little back, you know, I come from a family of entrepreneurs. So my grandfather was into real estate. He built a hotel in Lagos and had some, you know, what you call sort of neighborhood retail that we spent time working at as kids, me and my cousins. And, you know, my dad, along with his brothers, all had entrepreneurial pursuits. All of my dad but one is not an entrepreneur. And the one who isn't an entrepreneur is a brain surgeon. So you can imagine growing up in a household like ours where there was nothing you could do to ever impress anybody. So, you know, my dad was a serial entrepreneur. And in addition to that, he obviously built his office. He built our house and he had another office that he built and rented out as well. So, one of the things that my dad and I did, which, funny enough, I still do what I do with my kids today, is, you know, we just get into the car and we just drive around. We go to the ritzy part of town and just look at all these old, audacious houses that people build and just checking and just sort of looking. And it's become such a, you know, occupational hazard for me right now, because, you know, I'm that guy. I'm still that guy, right? Who's like always looking at different buildings and checking out different architecture.
Yeah.
So I've always sort of had that subconsciously embedded in me. But when I came to America, I tell everybody the story about how, you know, my dad had always encouraged me to be an entrepreneur, even in the States at the time when I didn't even think it was fathomable. So he, you know, again, so he sort of embedded that in me. So as far as I'm concerned, I always knew that I was going to be an entrepreneur, and I was frankly industry agnostic. I the purpose of me moving to San Francisco was because I thought I could be the next Mark Zuckerberg and start this online company. It was during the dot-com boom. I was very excited. You know, I participated in the California Gold Rush, or the second wave of the California Gold Rush, as you would call it.
Yeah.
And so I was out there, and anyway, so that company imploded. And I found myself for the very first time in my life just being unemployed. And something remarkable just happened to me. A very good friend of mine had reached out to me, basically saying his brother was looking for someone with my skill sets. And it was weird because I didn't even know what my skill set.
What are your skill sets?
So I thought it was funny when he said that. I was actually worried that his brother would take him seriously, because the only thing that he, that only thing that me and my friend did were just party, right? We just partied there. We just. So I was shocked that he actually felt that I was a serious person. But
yeah.
But my friend told his brother, was like, look, Boo was the kind of guy that we all got upset at, because even though we partied all the time with Boo, he would come back from the club, wash his face, sit down, and hit the books. And he was always that guy who was always serious and got good grades, while the rest of us just sort of, you know, just,
yeah.
But so I interviewed with this company, and I read their business plan, and it was love at first sight for me. I remember the day like it was yesterday. Like, if I had said anything more during my phone interview, I really felt that I was very, very desperate.
Yeah.
Just, you know, I'm turned into a stan, right? So like, I literally fell in love with the company. So the company is called Real Estate Resource Group. They're actually still around till today. And their business model was very simple, very straightforward, which was they audited leases for Fortune 500 companies throughout the United States.
Okay. Yeah.
So I cut a deal with them, and I said, look, I don't even want to get paid. I just want to come and learn. And if you just move me and my belongings down to DC and just pay for my move, and I'll work for free for 90 days. And if we find that, you know, that there is synergies between the two of us, then let's figure out a way to cut a deal on day 65, and hopefully by day 90, the deal will be finalized. And day 91 is when you start paying me a salary. That was basically my offer to them.
Nice.
And they basically took me up on my offer and moved me to DC. And that's when I got into real estate law. There were two things I learned working at that company, was just digging into real estate agreements. The fact that they're pretty straightforward. Like, whatever's in the agreement is pretty much what's in the pro forma.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of, for me, it was just very easily deciphered. Like, I could decipher it, I could comprehend it, and I could sort of put it.
Isn't it boring, though? It's kind of boring looking at those documents, leases all day, right?
Not that there was a huge dollar sign attached to it. So I could open up a lease and compare it against the general ledger and determine that my client was $1 million short. And we got, you know, we got paid over you know, however how much commission. I mean, our commission was, we were being paid for performance, which to me was another phenomenal aspect of the business plan. So if you did not perform, don't pay me, right? So I loved that aspect, because it just showed that there was alignment between us and our clients, and frankly, the landlord. And we were, I mean, it was a phenomenal experience for a young man just to be able to read a document, find mistakes, and get paid for it. That was it. So it was at that moment that I realized that I also want to be that landlord to overcharge tenants. And
yeah,
about becoming that landlord. And that's when I enrolled into the Johns Hopkins program. And that's when I fully immersed myself into real estate.
That's awesome. So you kind of fell into it, but you liked it. And you were like, all right, I'm going to follow. Now I want to be on the landlord side, not just the services side.
Correct.
Now, where did the affordable housing component come from? Did you have like, was that something you've always had a, did you have a passion for giving back at some point? Did you love affordable housing? I mean, I know you said that you like were in the apartments, you wanted like less, couldn't afford the rent. But like, I mean, was there deeper than that?
Yeah, it was. It was actually. So, you know, look, a couple of things, right? Like I tell folks, number one, when I decided to fully immerse myself in the real estate business and become a developer, the first thing I did was search around to see who I knew within my network. And that was like real doom and gloom for me because, you know, back then there weren't that many Black developers, right, up and down the East Coast. I only knew of one, and he lived in New York. So
who's that?
A good friend of mine by the name of Uche Alozier. So this was a young man who went to Columbia University and same thing, just sort of bootstrapping. In my eyes, he was like, you know, he's like, and it still is till today, my real estate guy. Like, he's just a phenomenal human being. So he was kind enough to let me shadow him. And I did that, learned some basics from him. And he encouraged me to come back to D.C. because D.C. was somewhat, at the time, a virgin territory. New York, as you can imagine, is very high cost. And it was very hard to break in. So I took his advice. I moved back to DC and decided to figure out a way to do deals. So that was number one major life turning point, right? So it's like, okay, mm-hmm. Who are the Black folks in my network that I can learn from? And realized very quickly that.
What's that guy's name?
Uche.
You got to introduce me.
More than happy to.
Sounds
so
like
that was number one turning point. Number two turning point was, as with everything else that I do, while I was at Johns Hopkins, I was really starting to educate myself about the real estate business and how one might be able to succeed in this space. And I realized very quickly that the type of transactions that most people do require significant amount of equity.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't have. And I think till today. So
now the equity is in your properties.
Correct. And I was very discouraged by that, right? Because, you know, I'm not connected that way to money. Mm-hmm. Did not know anybody that had money at the time.
But brain surgeon uncle.
He was at the time, I believe he was at the time, maybe in Saudi Arabia, if I'm not mistaken. So he was out of reach. So, yeah. So I again, like with everything else. So I got discouraged initially, but I felt like, look, there's got to be more to this than going to market with rap. So I put a pause on my plan to be a developer simply because I just didn't have the financial wherewithal to do so. And I decided to open up a consulting practice where I lent my project management expertise to mom and pop developers in the area. So what does that mean? You've got, you know, Joe Blow guy who is a contractor and sort of making that shift to developing properties for other people or developing properties for his own books. And he realized that he doesn't have, you know, the requisite knowledge to be able to translate his vision to the capital markets, right? So he's got relationship with banks. So I'm that guy who puts together a nice glossy package to be able to go secure financing for him with the people that he knew. So he had the sight, he had the vision, he had the plans, he had everything ready to go. He just didn't have the, you know, the patience to sit down and write, as well as the project management skills that were needed to move the project along. So because of my ability to help a lot of folks like that in the area, guess what happened? I got exposed to a lot of transactions. Mm-hmm. And I call it, you know, the second defining moment in my life, because it was a beautiful internship is how I looked at it. Someone was actually paying me to learn real estate development. I was basically learning on someone else.
You're learning, right? You got the lease thing. Now you're doing this. Yeah, it's awesome.
Correct. So that's how I parlayed all of those relationships into more clients, and came in contact with a particular client who was thinking about diversifying his portfolio to do something other than for sale housing. And he tasked me with researching this particular type of housing. And that is basically what opened my eyes to the possibility of being a developer, and the rest is history.
That's awesome, man. So you're learning, you're getting confidence. How did you do your first deal? How do you do that? There's a lot of people who want to be like developers. I guarantee 99.9% of them don't actually do it. So like, how did you start?
Sure. So I talked about my consulting practice. So guess what? The consulting practice has not changed. It's still in effect, right? It's still there. It's actually one of the main primary reasons of how we go about securing deals. So you're asking a question of how I did my very first real estate deal. So by this time, I'd been doing a lot of for-fee work for a number of nonprofits and for-profits in town, right? So there are folks who are just like, look, I don't have the time or the energy or the staff to devote to activating this project. Can you do it? And I said, sure. And they paid me a developer fee to do it. So for all intent and purposes, almost everybody that was involved in the project thought the project was mine. And I think I kind of may have carried myself in that manner. Like, oh, this is my deal. So everybody had to listen to me. One of my clients at the time had a site. It was actually a public-private partnership. So I convinced him to respond to a district RFP. And, you know, he said yes, he was going to do it. He wanted to get more into the development space. And guess what? We won the RFP. And as part of my engagement with him, I said, look, not only was I going to write the RFP for the event that he won the RFP, I was going to be his development guy, right? Makes sense. Yeah. So here we are chugging along, trying to move the deal forward, trying to activate the deal.
You know, if you're doing it all, I mean, you kind of do, but do you actually?
By this time I knew what I was doing. I'm a quick learner.
Yeah, that was okay.
I'm a quick learner, but somehow I knew what I was doing. I was pretty confident. And, one of the things that I quickly learned in when you're doing public-private partnership is your books have to be as clean as a whistle. Really, really clean. And at any moment's time, whenever they ask for requisite documentation for your company, have to be prepared to produce those documents. Otherwise, you easily put yourself out of contention. So what does that mean? This particular client got into some tax trouble and he was unable to make his tax payment. And there is a box you check when you apply or you're about to close on public-private partnerships. And that box basically says, are you in compliance with all of your tax obligations? Because they can't award or give you a site if you owe them money. So obviously checking that box. Normally checking the box when that's not the case is, you know, good. You subject yourself to jail time, and nobody, you know, wanted that to happen. So he was in the midst of forfeiting the deal. And in order not to do so, I asked him if I could step into his shoes. And luckily he said yes. He and I cut a deal, and that's how I was able to move that particular transaction.
Awesome. Was that an affordable deal or just market rate?
It was an affordable deal. It was? Yeah.
And then there, you know, that comes with a lot of, you know, more compliance and all that kind of stuff. Did you?
Sure.
I guess you just have to, like, people, I think people, that scares a lot of people off from doing those deals, like all that regulatory stuff you got to deal with. Did you find that kind of easy to comply with? Was it hard? Did you just say, hey, this is, and did you pick affordable housing too, possibly because maybe there's kind of a, almost like a higher barrier of entry in the sense that you need to know a little bit more?
You definitely have to know a little bit more. You have to, you know, you have to be, it's a community development deal, right? You know, market rate deals are pretty straightforward, right? You buy the site, you get entitled, you secure your debt, you secure equity, you're up to ground. You know, on, with community-based deal, it's not just the real estate, right? That it's everything else that you have to do in order to move the transaction forward. And that really means, you know, boots on the ground, entrenching yourself in the community, people know who you are, and building a coalition of supporters to vouch for you and speak to your character. So
require going around knocking on doors, going to the local stores. Like, what do you, like the local, you know, city councilman or something? How do you?
Yeah, at the time, you know, I got to tell you, at the time, that's probably one of the best part of my jobs, right? At the time, best part of my job is, you know, it's like, you know, you and I were talking earlier about Biggie Smalls, right? Like, if you think about it, you know, what was it that rappers were doing back in the day to get their names out, right? They had a street team. Like, I think you could probably recall the days of the Bad Boy street team or the Rough Riders street team, right? Yeah. We still employ those same tactics still today, to be very honest with you, Chris. Like, I love that. I love the fact that, you know, we get to be in a community and build a coalition of supporters to come in, again, speak to our characters, support the transaction, and encourage the politicians that, you know, this, again, using public land for public good is a good thing.
Well, you can count Chris Papa as part of the BUA street team.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's awesome, man. Well, it's an amazing story. Where are you taking Dantes over the next couple of years? Like, what's your vision, your goal for this company?
Vision and goal for the company, again, is it's all, you know, again, it's all stems around making sure that we don't lose sight of our customers, right? We're trying to create an environment for our customers whereby they get to enjoy the same amenities that you know, high income earners have. So that's number one. So number one is, you know, don't lose sight of the North Star, right? It's just create decent quality, you know, affordable spaces for people to live in. Obviously, as you can imagine, since the company has evolved, you know, other visions that I have is how do we use our bully pulpit to help build other companies, particularly other companies of color. So as you can imagine, you know, in 2018, 2019, we closed on 4 transactions. I think all those 4 transactions probably amounted to close to about $300 to $400 million, right? So that's $300 to $400 million worth of purchasing power that we have. So, you know, now we have an opportunity to dictate who the architect is, who the contractor is, who the interior designer is, permit expediter, and all other vendors that you typically come in contact with when you do real estate development transactions like the ones that we do, and create that ecosystem to help build small minority-owned businesses. Because again, as far as I'm concerned, it starts from the top. So that's part of, you know, again, another part of my job that I truly, truly enjoy. The third part of the job, the third vision, again, is to create more, is to expose more African Americans to business, right? So, you know this, right? You see this all the time. you know, and I, you know, we all know what the stats are in terms of the percentage of representation that minorities have in the real estate space. What is it, 1%? It's bad.
Pretty bad, man. I mean, just as a, on a hiring front, many companies are now, I mean, they're making a real effort to try, and at least they're saying that, you know what I mean? So they didn't say that, yeah. You know, they didn't say
yeah, they would.
Now yeah. They can definitely, it's definitely a point.
Right. Then you come to my company today and I'll be, you know, you look around and my company, out of the almost 40 people that work for me, you know, 98% are people that look like, right? So we're creating opportunities for, so I don't know what it is that we're doing differently, but I'm not exactly sure why we're the exact opposite of the entire industry. And when, you know, and I dare say that we're doing phenomenally well. I mean, if you look at, you know, what's been happening during COVID and look at our performance versus that of other firms, I think we stand heads and shoulders above a lot of the majority firms out here. So, you know, yeah, look, we're creating environments and creating communities is always going to be our thing. I mean, clearly that's how we're able to survive and to, you know, hire the top flight talent that we have. But like I said, it's one thing to use this vehicle that we have to really create an opportunity to have more people that look like me be in this particular space. So that's what I'm spending a lot of my time working on. I've always been doing it. We've always been doing it, but we'll continue to do that.
I'm going to do a podcast series, I think. I just decided on race and real estate. So maybe you can get participate in that and like panel discussion maybe, and we could dive in deeper.
Cool.
That's awesome, man. Because it's a huge topic, more than we can cover in this podcast. So I was debating if I should even go down that road, but I think we should table that for another.
It's Christmas. Let's lighten up the spirit of it.
On that note, let's jump into the hot seat. You ready?
No, I'm not, but okay.
Oh! Which, any books that you recommend, whether real estate, life, business, whatever?
Outliers. I always go back to that book.
Is that the Malcolm Gladwell one?
The Malcolm Gladwell book.
Yeah, that's a good one. He's so good.
10,000 Hours. I tell everybody. It's my favorite book.
Sorry. Yeah. How about podcast recommendations, if any?
Oh, what's that? Podcast recommendations. Obviously, you got to listen to the Peace Papa podcast.
Yeah.
But you know about that?
Nope.
You know, I tend to want to like lighten my load. So obviously, like, you know, I'm listening to the Joe Biden podcast is what I spend my time listening to.
Oh, yeah? Nice.
Yeah. So I listen to a lot, you know, because, you know, it's just quirky and funny and intelligent as well. So whenever I have like, you know, an hour or two to spare, I'm listening to the Joe Biden podcast. And obviously Noriega has a podcast called Drink Champs, which can be very interesting.
Nice.
Some pretty interesting interviews.
What do you like to do outside of work?
I love cycling. You know, being on my bicycle, go to the adventure is something that, and of course, you know, it just takes me back to my childhood days, especially when I'm riding with my friends. I'm telling you, like, I'm riding with my friends. For some reason, I just see us, like, transforming to, like, our 16-year-old selves.
Yeah.
And running around the neighborhood. It's fun. It's great. It's challenging. It's exactly what life is about. You've got deeps. You've got valleys. You've got flats. You've got hills. It's really the way life is. And your attitude towards how you attack the hills is basically going to be your attitude to how you attack challenge and time. So, yeah. And, you know, it takes me places. So that's the one thing I love doing.
You said you have kids too? You have kids?
I do. You know, they're just really, really smart. I'm starting to believe that they're too, you know, I'm not that guy that they used to look at anymore with like all the answers.
How old
are they? 12 and 14.
Oh.
So spending time with them is, you know, like we were out the other day, it was just the three of us, and we had a really good time. We had a ball. So spending time with them is great.
I have a 10-year-old, so he's still, yeah, he's getting to that point where he looks at me like, you don't know what you're talking about. He'll learn. Oh, I'm super smart. He'll learn. What advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
What advice would I give to my 20-year-old self? Yeah, it's funny. I was actually telling a couple of my young friends this the other day, which is savor the moment that you're in now. You don't really get to appreciate. It's like when I was very young and I was broke, I was, you know, at the time I was very, you know, like focused on making money and being able to provide for the family. And I just sort of missed out on a lot of stuff. Right.
Mm.
Because, you know, being an entrepreneur, that's what it takes, right? It takes, you know, an intense amount of focus.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I didn't enjoy all the wins. Hey, I didn't savor the moment. I didn't really appreciate the peaks and the valleys, right? Particularly the valleys, because, you know, it just put me in a rut as opposed to, you know, embracing them and saying that this is just, you know, that this too shall pass. So I tell folks now, I'm like, look, embrace the moment that you're in. Be very, very patient. Don't rush to make money. Do not let money be the reason why you're doing something. And think very, very long term. Short-sightedness is going to break you. If you're doing anything, look at it with an eye towards what's it going to look like 10 years from. How do you want it to look like 10 years from now? 10 years. And that's what I tell myself now. But I wish I'd know.
Yeah. So it's hard sometimes. It's hard to have perspective. Now, I am a recruiter, as you know. Many people here are probably figuring out, how do I get into a company like Dante's or a company I want to join? What do you look for when you're hiring people? What kind of qualities?
Grit, a lot of grit. Obviously, passion. You know, I've been very, very fortunate that a good number of the people that work with me, for me at the company, are passionate about affordable housing. They're passionate about creating opportunities for other Black-owned businesses, and are passionate about ownership, right? So all of that combined is what makes us who we are. So I always tell folks, like, look, I can teach you real estate. I can teach you how to be a really good developer. But if you don't have passion for what you're doing, if you don't care about what you're doing, you don't want to see a significant amount of change happening in this world, you know, this place is not for you. At least at Dante's Partners is not for you, because the people who work here, you know, we don't look at things as like, oh, 9 to 5 or anything like that. Like, people are working because they want to see stuff done, and they care about the fact that every day we linger or we waste or we sit on our laurels, it's a family or an individual that doesn't get housed. And nobody wants that to happen because of change there. So, yeah, passion is key. I'm a very passionate guy. So if you don't have the passion for what you're doing, it's just not going to work in the culture of the organization.
Well, it comes across. I appreciate that. Yeah. You have a big why, not just a how, right? There's a why behind it, a bigger picture. Obua Benitier, principal at Dante's Partners, thank you for your story and your time. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you taking the moment to learn our story and giving us a platform to talk more about what we're doing. And I'm happy to reconnect again in the future. Appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Resume, a Jackson Lucas podcast, where we take a deep dive into the career journeys of some of the top minds in real estate and equip you with the knowledge to move forward in your path towards the success you've envisioned. Make sure to like, share, and subscribe to Beyond the Resume. We're grateful for your support. All episodes of Beyond the Resume are brought to you by Jackson Lucas, building inclusive and diverse businesses through talent acquisition. Visit us at jacksonlucas.com.